Hello and welcome to the Tomorrow Brands podcast, where we explore what it takes to build a brand of tomorrow. I'm your host, Ruth Fittock, and today I'm joined by Richard Peak, MD at Merchant Gourmet, a brand that's quietly transformed the pulses and grains aisle into something people actually get excited about. We talk about building brands at scale without losing soul, what it means to create a truly empowering culture, and how Merchant Gourmet's obsession with product, people, and purpose led to its recent acquisition by Premier Foods. Let's get into it. Thanks for coming on. It'd be great to start with you. So how did you get here? What's your journey been to Merchant Gourmet?
Yeah, actually, I've always been in consumer goods. So I started my career actually at Mars Chocolate in Slough. I was there for probably 8 or 9 years. Really enjoyed it. A great foundation in business. They put loads of time and effort into personal development and training. And yeah, I think I did get to a point there where I felt like I wanted to do something where I felt I could make more of a difference. And probably by that, the type of product I'm selling and how much impact that had in the kind of greater world, but also the amount of difference you can make in just such a massive organization. I just had a craving for something a bit more entrepreneurial. So really from that point onwards, I've been at small to medium size, but fast growing consumer goods businesses, helping them kind of scale. And yeah, I seem to have got into a series of what you might describe as slightly boring, begrudged sort of categories, whether that be like pet food in terms of Lily's Kitchen or household cleaning with Method Ecover, even into sort of pulses and grains now with Merchant Gourmet, which is actually a space I really enjoy because it's taking enduring trends, but trying to find a way to find an edge and make them culturally relevant. So yeah, that's been my journey.
So you've got a mix there of challenger and corporate experience. What did you bring forward from your corporate background and what did you consciously leave behind?
Oh yeah, good question. I think what I learned in the corporate background is, I guess what I call like the hygiene factors that are just super important in any business, which is having really clear structures, processes, framework, the importance of good insight, where these businesses, I always say big businesses are big for a reason because they're super successful and they're good at what they do. I've very much taken those with me in terms of not, I'd probably flip that on its head a little bit and say in small, medium-sized businesses, you have to work out where your angles are or your points of difference. That can definitely be in the culture. It can definitely be in having a mission and a purpose that you like people really truly believe in. And also probably a little bit where people are feeling all the bumps in the road, like really genuinely feel it. The highs are high and the lows are genuinely low, but actually that level of feeling that close to what you're doing, it creates a certain culture and vibe that actually you can't copy. And also then linked to that, once you've got the structure and the process, I actually think the ability to move really quickly within that is a very significant competitive advantage. I liken it to having children, which I have to at the moment because I've got young kids. So they are a lot of my world. And it's just so interesting. Like children particularly have to have structure. If you don't give them like some level of structure and framework to operate within, it's good luck. And I think so do just human beings broadly in general. But then outside of that defined structure, what they're amazing at play, like being creative, testing and learning, make believe, getting things wrong, working out what hasn't happened. You see how they operate and think that's such a great way of doing things differently and being creative. They're so much more inquisitive and creative than we are because we've had that hammered out of us. So anyway, weird analogy. I'm going down a rabbit hole here.
I love it. I've never heard of that. And I too have small kids and it's suddenly like pinging my brain because I'm thinking the structure, but then also when you give kids autonomy within a structure in which they feel safe, magical things happen as well.
100%, because they'll take more risks. Like they'll actually be, if they know that I'm not, so this is the cultural thing and this is, I'm like bringing it back to business, but if people know that they can take risks, as long as they've operated within a structure and they've kept to the defined rules, which is don't do anything too rogue, they're actually prepared to spread their wings and take more risks because they know that there's only so far they can fall. And if they do, there's this like nurturing environment that sits underneath them, say, that's fine, what have you learned? And let's move on. And so I do think the small, medium-sized business thing, if you can be the, okay, you've got all the structure and process that you get in a big business, but actually you've got so much more freedom and empowerment and license just to go have fun and try things. I think that is like a bit of a magic sauce, actually.
I think that's what people want, isn't it? Autonomy. I saw a survey of all those employee engagement things you can do, like pizzas on a Friday and ping pong and all those things. But actually, it was the number one thing was autonomy, that unique sense of feeling like what you're doing is having a direct impact, but then within a kind of safe environment where you've got the process and structure and regular bedtime. It's very important.
Yeah, exactly. I can tell I'm talking to somebody who's in it and been there and knows it. Yeah, a good little, what's the word, like saying or metaphor which I've used before, and it will bore anybody who knows me, is like roots and wings. So it's like with the family, it's like the aim is give you just amazingly deep roots and like this kind of loving, nurturing, safe environment, basically, so you can just go and fly. And if, you know, something goes wrong, the roots are always there. I think you can then use that across into business as well.
Yeah. And I think that sort of psychological safety is important when you're asking people to take risks. I mean, my longest company that I worked in was very much like that. There was no blame culture. So it meant then that people did take risks versus other places I've worked where it's not like that. And actually it changes the way that you think. And even those sort of people operating from a place of fear versus that more expansive thinking because they've got nice solid roots.
Totally agree. And like, I actually think that's quite rare. I've been in places or know of places where they would say we've got this really empowering, psychologically safe environment, whereas actually it's not. And actually they're almost the worst ones because have this pretense, but actually if things do go wrong, people getting slightly thrown under the bus or like people starting to shout. Why would anyone ever shout in a business? Like just that it's great. And as soon as that happens, all of that empowerment goes immediately. You know, behavior breeds behavior, doesn't it? I actually think it's quite rare to have that true empowerment.
I think it's quite a nice alternative view from the sort of hustle culture, relentless driving forward. It's a really hard balance to strike because when you're building something and you're building it and it's growing quickly, the fast pace is overwhelming. The difference then between those two environments can be the difference between a team that burns out and you lose everybody and they might be physically there, but they're not mentally there anymore. And that's not great for anybody. And then a team who's thriving under that pressure, because it's not always easy growth, is it? It's not, it has its own challenges.
Yeah, totally. This is where it goes full circle, because this is why I love the play analogy, because when are you not, but you're not burnt out when you're playing and where you're doing the things that give you energy. You're burnt out when you're spending huge amounts of your time doing energy depleting activities. And I think it's a perfect world, but if you can get to a point where in general you're encouraging people to two things, actually. One is take risks, play, have fun, because that's only going to give you energy. But two is just encourage people to show up at work as themselves. We've all been there, but it's exhausting when you're trying to be somebody else all the time. But actually, if truly you can allow people to show up and say, look, the culture is just bring yourself to work, you do your best work and it's less tiring. No, I totally agree. You can sort of create the climate and the environment where it feels a bit more energy giving than energy sapping.
Do you think there's a line of take yourself to work? Because I feel like in principle, I agree with you, but I know among friends of there's been this sort of generational shift in how open people are about maybe things that are going on in their personal lives, which maybe for some of us who are older, you would previously have like gone to work and just got on with it. And I'm not saying that either is right or wrong, But that, I guess the broad stereotypical thing is the Gen Z, isn't it, versus the millennial manager. I had an example of somebody who was very upset at work one day because they'd forgotten to pay the balance of their Glastonbury ticket and had so lost their ticket and then couldn't come to the team meeting because they were too upset. And that, for some people, they would feel like, this is me bringing my authentic self to work today. And trying to find the line there between there's a certain level of your at work, there's a certain amount of professionalism expected versus the sort of stiff upper lip that we probably came up in, which wasn't right either. And I think we're in a tricky in-between period where we're trying to manage that.
Yeah, it's a great question. I guess when it gets to that point, it has to be by individual as well, doesn't it? To a degree, like some people are just more comfortable sharing and some people aren't. My instinct is always further towards the bring yourself piece, just in general. Like, what did I hear the other day? It was quite a good sort of phrase from somewhere being like, I'd rather people didn't like the real me than liked the fake me, because I'll spend so long, you know, getting somebody to like a version of myself that's just exhausting to be. And actually, they're not really my friend. Do you know what I mean? Like, I do think the same thing at work. I think if you're constantly putting on a front that is exhausting, you can overshare at work. Yeah, probably, because it makes other people uncomfortable. It's a tricky line.
I think, don't get me wrong, that the shift is going in the right direction as to people having an understanding of people being whole people, not just severance work machines, then yes, in the lift. It's these kind of changes feel quite rapid, I think, sometimes when you look at over in the last sort of 5-10 years how workplace and idea of workplace has shifted.
And I think I've found little things like you can just put little mechanisms in place just to help people bring a bit of the outside in that's not like wildly distracting, like somebody running around trying to get a Glastonbury ticket. A couple of things we do, we have our weekly huddle and we always start with somebody just talking about an interest, and they'll just do a quick 10 minutes about this is what, like the diversity and team, the business is just so interesting. And again, that's just a great opportunity for people to take a bit of that outside and remind people that we're all actually human beings outside of work. And then sometimes in meetings, we'll start off with just a quick download by person, which starts to feel a bit corporate at that point, even the word. Maybe we need to rebrand that booth. But the idea being that we've all got stuff in our mind that's distracting us. Just have an opportunity to download and then we're present. I've got this off my chest. I've done this thing and now I'm present. Again, none of it's perfect, but it just helps, for which then people can focus within.
Yeah, I think that's really nice. And again, I guess it comes back to that. There's a certain extent of autonomy, isn't it? If you're like, I'm really tired today because one of my kids was up late, or because I had loads of fun this weekend, so I'm going to do some like low-key tasks. But then tomorrow, I'm going to be like back on it double time. Fine. Like, we're grown-ups. We give people that to manage. If they're coming to work every day saying, I'm really hungover, I'm not going to do anything, then you've got a problem. But there's a sort of amount of let people manage their own energy and work around that. As long as you're delivering, it doesn't matter, does it?
Yeah, agreed.
We used to say at Podchips, we were on a task-based, not time-based culture. So it was, we were still pretty much 9 to 5 in the office, but that kind of flexibility on, it's 3 p.m., I'm just going to go out and have a coffee for a bit, or I'm going to go to the gym because that works better for me. No one cares, because there's an amount of trust there that you're going to deliver. And if you're not delivering, then that's another issue. But that's what makes places people want to work.
And you've got to trust people to manage their own energy. Like, I, for example, I know about myself that if I hack into London in the middle of a commute, I'm not going to show up particularly well for the first half hour in the office, because I'll feel like a bit compressed, but also I've just done nothing. I much more prefer either coming in early, but usually later actually, and having a coffee on the train, doing a bit of work, having a bit of thinking time in a slightly calmer environment. And then you look back and think, why did we insist that everybody got in at 9 o'clock to sit at a desk in a different place, kill themselves for rush hour with no meetings until 10:30? It's a trust thing, because it was, look, if they're not at their desk, they're probably at the gym or doing their own thing. And out of interest, would you be office-based now, or do you think things have moved on and like work should be hybrid or fully remote? Where do you stand on that?
My reasons are personal, but I am fully on hybrid, because as a working mum, if I'd been forced back into an office Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, like I just wouldn't be here. I wouldn't have had a career. I would have dropped out the workforce. Yeah, I'm probably going to go off on now because I just feel so passionately about it. But I think you just lose so much talent from the workplace, mostly women of a certain age, if you make it too restrictive, and that there's absolutely no reason why you can't work from home so that you can be there to send your kids off to school and then make them tea at night. And that can make all the difference. So I think absolutely being in an office, you need to have FaceTime with people too. I think hybrid is the answer. But that flexibility that came from COVID that kind of redefined the workplace, I think that was a game changer for so many people. And then the creep back is disappointing. I think it's better for everybody. And I think you see more men taking it up too, which means that it's becoming more balanced. I just think it's been a really positive change. My business now is different. We're pretty much fully remote, but try to get together in London once or twice a week. So I guess that is hybrid. But also means you can work around your own energy levels. My business partner loves a late night working session. She'll stay up to 1 a.m. Whereas I'm dead by 6:30. I go hard during probably more conventional office hours. And that's what works for both of us. And to your point of making people come in at 9, I think it's the benefit of smaller businesses where you have that trust and that tighter group of people, you can do that. I think as you start to scale probably and you get to 100 plus employees, maybe that's when it becomes a bit harder.
Yeah, it goes back to that thing that you need more clearly defined rules, don't you? Because, you know, there'll be the exceptional few that take advantage. That's when it becomes difficult. I think you have to be really careful about prescribing to people what work-life balance is. It's always interesting how it's actually, I don't know, some countries or businesses are like, you can't send emails after this particular time, like after 5:30, whereas actually, do you know what? That doesn't represent balance to me, because I'd much rather do it then, because that I've put the kids to bed, or like I've got more energy then and do something a little bit later, or actually my work-life balance tilts more towards work and I'm totally fine with that. But I'd find it very stressful if someone dictated when I can and can't work, because then I've got to fit into boundaries and parameters that actually are out of kilter with how I operate, where my energy comes from, what my life looks like. A bit of work at the weekend, for me, it works really well because I know I can get up early and just get some stuff done, and then it's not hanging over me and I'm more present. Yeah, I struggle a bit sometimes as well with, I guess it's when anyone predefines how you should work.
I completely agree. I read once that you get two types of people. You're either a compartmentalizer or you're a sort of free flower. And for compartmentalizers, those are the people who really thrive in 9 to 5. And when you're at work, you're at work. And when you're at home, you're at home. And then there's another type of person who can dip in and out. And for both of those people, that's just what works for them. Neither is right or wrong. It's just a frame of mind. I think trying to set up structures that accommodate those, rather than being like, to your point, this is work-life balance. And if you want to check your emails while you're on holiday for 30 minutes in the morning, because then you actually genuinely relax rather than think, what's in my inbox, then maybe that's a good thing.
That's so interesting. It's so interesting you say that. Well, because I'll give you a really good example. We, as you'd expect, we're like surveying people and saying, what's working, what isn't, what would you like to see? And I remember we had a kind of leadership team meeting. It was like, a lot of people are asking for summer hours where it's, okay, on a Friday, we're going to finish at 1 and blah, blah. And I was like, I think that's so sad that people have asked for that. Fine, but do we really need a rule to tell people? Like, it almost feels the ante of what we're trying to do. But the feedback was actually some people want the permission. To your point on being a compartmentalizer, some people want and need the very clear permission that they can and are going to finish at 1 on a Friday in order for them to really be clear on that and enjoy that bit of time. This free flowing side of, oh, that's cool, I've done what I need to do and I'll finish now. You're right, it comes all the way back to that same thing. Give people enough structure where they actually can operate within it, as opposed to feeling discombobulated by zero guardrails.
So we've talked about culture at Merchant Gourmet and how that shaped a team. But I also wanted to ask about a huge recent milestone, the acquisition of Merchant Gourmet by Premier Foods. Congratulations. It's a huge moment for the brand. Was that always the plan? Were you building it with an exit in mind?
Yeah, very much. I think we were always quite open about that with everybody that worked for the business. The way we've always referred to it is that our job is to build enterprise value. But actually, the way to do that is through growth, profitability, brand recognition. So the two things go hand in hand. But yeah, ultimately, you build enterprise value to a really good point and an exit will probably come. So yeah, we've always been quite open about at some point, that's the plan, but don't over-focus on it.
How did that feel? Was there anything surprising?
The process or the actual exit itself?
I guess both, because they're two separate things, aren't they?
Yeah, good question. I think it's hard. It's like naturally, it's very hard because essentially it's like having two jobs because you need to run the business and the business has got to keep growing and being successful. But also you are going through a process, which is a very, obviously for obvious reasons, full on process, which takes a lot of time. Hard work. I think there's bits of it. I don't know whether it's surprising, but there's bits of it that I found tricky. Because naturally, and of course, you have to keep it very confidential. And we talked a bit about culture, but we have a really open culture just within the team and the business. And we talk about everything. So at times probably feels a bit uncomfortable saying, oh, myself and the leadership team are off for another day just doing some strategy work. And everyone being like, really? But it's interesting because actually when it comes to the announcement and you announce it to everybody, they're like, of course you had to keep it confidential. Makes total sense. So you can tie yourself up a bit in knots on that one. And yeah, in the harder times you can start to feel a bit defensive on the due diligence side where people start questioning decisions you made 3 years ago, which you already knew weren't the right decision, and you have to go over some of that territory. But again, you have to remember the questions are all coming from a good place in order for somebody to extract the value that they need to out of it to put a really good bid in. Ultimately, it's a roller coaster, but ultimately, clearly, it's a hugely rewarding thing when it actually happens. And you're like, wow, someone's prepared to pay this for this thing that I've spent so long building is an amazing feeling. Yeah. So it's a roller coaster, I could have said.
And the end, sort of when it all goes through, was that like pure joy or were you just exhausted?
Definitely a mixture of the both. I think it's definitely joy because, yeah, I guess it's the thing that you've been working towards for so long. And it's a real milestone, the completion of an amazing chapter. But you do look ahead and say, God, given the partner, there's now so much to go after. There's also a lot to do, clearly, as soon as that moment happens, because there's a lot of columns and there's a lot of people to talk to and it has to be done in the right way. And then when the adrenaline goes, there is some level of exhaustion for definite.
And you're staying on within the business. What does that mean for you personally now, stepping into that MD role within a larger organization?
Yeah, I think personally, it's really exciting because of who the organization is. The mission and vision of the business is always to put more everyday gourmet moments into people's everyday meals. And we've always stood by that, but through really good plant-based ingredients and clean ingredients, this just means we'll be able to do that at scale. And Premier Foods clearly have an incredible track record of creating massive scale brands and businesses. So it's, God, this is what we need and the business needs to do that. And what a big driver for me is creating value and growing fast, and that clearly is a big opportunity to do that. So yeah, it's a sort of exciting moment to take the business into that next chapter. And clearly it would be remiss not to say that there's a transition and it's a new partner and you have to manage people and a business through that, which isn't always easy. But I think the one thing that everybody said when we talked about it is we needed it. It needed a new partner who's got genuine firepower, and it, what better partner than somebody who's proven they can do it again and again.
So we talked a lot about culture. Do you think that the kind of unique culture you've created has played a role in making Merchant Gourmet acquirable?
Yes, I definitely do. I think that there's elements of the culture. We talked a lot around team and empowerment, where it's a style and a leadership style, which I think I do believe led us to taking market share and disproportionate growth. But I actually think there's elements of the culture, like being obsessed with food, being obsessed with quality, new products that creates a point of difference around the brand that actually people look at and say, that's something really interesting that I want in my organization. And probably that's something that it's incredibly difficult to create from scratch. And those things then clearly you derive value from that because it's something that potentially you can do yourself. So yeah, probably split into two bits on that. But yeah, Premier were always quite clear that they're buying a brand and a business that they think they can grow and that's exciting, and also a team who have the sort of necessary skills, capability and culture who they can learn a bit from as well as we can learn from them. So it felt like a kind of a sort of symbiotic relationship, if you like, from that point of view.
And do you think it's possible to keep the same small business agility now that you've got Premier's backing?
Yeah, early. It's probably early to answer that. But I think, you know, the reality is, and I think you do need to be realistic, what was our competitive advantage where we didn't have somebody with the firepower and scale of Premier, I think probably was our agility, our ability to make quick decisions and just do things on the fly. Is that going to be our competitive advantage now? It might be part of it. And it'd be lovely to think that actually we can continue to keep that and inject it into a bigger organization. But we're excited about the scale we can reach. The marketing team already seems to be doubling the budgets they think they're going to get overnight. But actually, our ability to reach more people, our ability to drive awareness with the knowledge, the know-how and the firepower of someone like a Premier Food. I imagine we can keep part of it, but actually we'll find other ways to generate competitive advantage too.
I'd like to go back and talk about category and to our very early point about sort of category disruption, because Merchant Gourmet were really early into plant-based, but that space has obviously evolved a lot. How have you navigated that shift?
Yeah. And actually, it's interesting because I don't really consider us disruptor. That's probably actually almost where I think I went wrong at the beginning. I should have caveat all of this. I should have said this at the beginning. I'm not a founder. I always say I take everyone else's really good work and then just help them grow it, which is a really important point because I always find it takes me a little while to get comfortable in the skin of somebody else. To your point onto the plant base and disruptivity, I think that when I joined, I was like, oh, this is interesting because actually everything is plant-based and we don't talk about it and it's a massive trend and we should be the plant-based disruptor and we can appeal to a younger audience. And I think we took that too far and had these sort of save the planet lines, and whereas actually that's never really what the business was founded on. The business was founded by two brothers who just loved food. They were like massive foodies, imported really interesting, great ingredients from around the world and sold it in retail. It was by coincidence plant-based and the messaging was almost quite jarring. It never really appealed to anyone. And it took a little while to say, actually, that's not what our consumers actually buy us for. Or if you ask them three words about Merchant Gourmet, it would not be plant-based. But it just doesn't really feel genuine and right to who we are. So we ended up doing, not full circle, but a pivot towards saying, look, the business is founded on amazing products that are minimally processed and taste amazing. So that's who we are. That's our DNA. And by the way, it's plant-based. And that's great because if we can make plants taste amazing and a bit more convenient and people eat a little bit more plants, that's good because it's probably better for people's health and probably better for the environment. But that's a kind of, you know, like a surprise and almost a surprise and delight thing that sits underneath. So to answer your question a bit more directly, the plant-based thing, I'd say we're much more veg forward. We focus on taste, quality and minimal processing. And I think that's an enduring trend that's never going to go away. People want good quality, sustainable food, not messed around with, that comes out of the ground. And then to make that culturally relevant in a way that consumer gets. So if you like, the disruption probably more comes from the obsession around that and the confidence in that position than it does taking a poke at anybody. So we're not, you know, we're not a vegan brand. We're not anti-meat at all. We're pro-plant. And that is quite an important difference in just our outlook. We'll use influencers and put recipe content out that shows our product with meat. We're just much, much more around quality ingredients and minimal processing.
And what about convenience? Because I feel like that I'm a big fan of the brand. And for me, it's the kind of good food very quickly. I have it for lunch, or if I've come back in from a commute from London. And I feel like you've done some really nice ad campaigns about that, which sort of play with your preconceptions of what like convenient food tastes like.
Yeah, exactly. What I always say is take an enduring trend and make it culturally relevant. So the enduring part we've covered, which is food that comes from the ground, blah, blah, blah. The culturally relevant bit is actually at the moment, people, one, are massively short on time, and two, they have incredibly high level of choice. The short on time bit is let's make this super convenient, like hyper convenient, 90 seconds ready to go. But also what you get in 90 seconds is a very high quality product that elevates, hopefully like elevates your meal and tastes amazing. So you might have loads of choice, but actually you're going to love this product. And they're the two bits that we've really tried to focus on, because it's solving, well, hopefully it's solving, you very nicely put a problem that a lot of people have, which is, do you know what? I'd rather cook a meal from scratch and spend time making it and enjoy it, but actually I don't always have time because people are busy.
And do you think that's helped? Because obviously we've been living through, still living in, although it's not been in the press as much, a cost of living crisis, and building a premium brand in an economic downturn on paper should feel like a challenge, but you guys seem to have continued to grow. How do you think you've managed that?
Another view I hold, like I'm not a big believer that premium brands should struggle in any kind of cost of living crisis or consumer confidence environment. Because if people know good value, if you're genuinely offering something that is really good value, they'll still buy it because people still want affordable luxuries. I think even in the deepest recessions, people still went on nice holidays. People still spent a lot of money on Christmas because they still want those things in their life. So you need to be in that sweet spot where it's actually, this is something I really want in my life. And I guess the second one is in food and drink. There's always something above it. People probably will cut back on eating out, or they'll definitely cut back on what I call middle tier eating out. Maybe they'll still do the special dinners every so often for an anniversary or a birthday, but they probably won't in the week pop out to ZZ's or whatever. But they'll still want an alternative to that. And you can be really well positioned to be the, okay, I won't get the takeaway for 50 quid, but I'll just make a really nice meal. And so I think it's more how you can position yourself, like never waste a good crisis. It's like, how can you position yourself to actually still be something that represents value? We've got a newish, we call it like meals in minutes range, which is hyper convenience because it's actually pretty much the whole meal and you can have it done in 90 seconds and it can sit in the cupboard, but it still tastes really good and it's still really healthy for you. Solves a lot of unmet consumer needs, but actually, you know, the value of that's quite good because it's £2.50. And so you can say we're a premium brand and we have a premium position, which we do, but actually I still think it's good value.
So one thing that's really fascinates me about Gourmet is how many SKUs you have. So you've got loads of different products across loads of different categories. So I just want to dig into that a bit. So firstly, what's your approach to NPD? How do you decide what's worth exploring? What's a distraction? How important is NPD to the business?
Yeah, really important. Actually, we have, I should sort of preface this with, we have a couple of red lines on NPD, which is unsurprisingly quality and taste. So we obsess over that and we make sure that blind tastings focuses to make sure the product really, there's clear blue water between anything else. Once we've got over that line, there is no limit to NPD. This is the like anti-big business strategy stuff where there is no fewer, bigger, better. So my view on NPD is that you can spend a long time and a huge amount of money and insight researching something to death, and you never know how it will do until the product is actually out there in the consumer's hands. You just won't. You can narrow down the risk, but you'll never know. And if you treat NPD as an iterative process and don't expect a silver bullet and perfection on every bit of NPD, and you take the feedback loop quickly and you make change quickly, I think it can be really effective. And again, going back right to the beginning, it's a big old competitive advantage because bigger players will not be prepared to do that for multiple reasons. They're just not set up to be able to do that. So the approach to NPD is very different. It's actually, if we feel we've got an exceptionally good product that is in a category where we have the right to play and win, and we can create something where there's clear blue water on taste and quality, we'll just chuck it out there. And B, it's back to the same thing. It's accept that it won't all work. Take the feedback. Either it doesn't work and you move on, or it partly works and you iterate and then you get something which really is working. And it's a refreshing way of doing it. Retailers like it because you're very honest when something doesn't work and you're the first going in saying, nah, take that out, delist that, but actually here's the iteration, here's why it doesn't work. And it is quite an empowering way to do it. It can be slightly chaotic though.
My next question is resource, because NPD can be, and especially for your marketing team, of like priorities of messaging, and how do you manage that?
Yeah, no, it's difficult. If you asked our marketing team, they would say it's very tricky, because that's definitely the downside, because how can you support that NPD? How can you really make sure people are aware that you've launched and that are educated in what the product is and how to do it? That is tricky. I guess what we do is we focus first on what I call winning at the point of purchase, just to make sure that people are aware that it's there and it's in the right place and there's theatre around it. Iterate, learn, and then say, okay, this is now ready for something more above the line.
Yeah, makes sense. I like it. I always say the market will decide. So your point about you never really know. And it's true. And there's rule breakers as well, right? There's things that just shouldn't work on paper. It happens all the time in like flavors of things. You do all this analysis and you look at all of the trends and all of the biggest selling flavors. And actually then you launch something weird that's just really good, shouldn't work, and it does. So there's always, it's really hard to find the balance between, obviously insight is really useful and helpful decision making, but there's also that sort of, so if there was a rule book, if there was a playbook, then every brand would be the same. We'd all be,
every product would be a unicorn, like straight away. If you could generate enough insight where you can guarantee a massive success, everyone would be smashing it. And it's interesting, and you must find this a lot. I find it fascinating how you can either go through gate processes or someone in a board can turn up and go, no, that won't work. It's like, well, or that artwork, that packaging, no one's going to pick that up. And it's, oh, that's interesting. So you must literally be able to represent 65 million people's views in what, that's incredible. Like how it, you just can't do it. But it's, yeah, which is why you just sometimes just have to put it out there.
Yes, I have had experience.
I could see a knowing look.
Someone my wife plays tennis with didn't like it. Yeah. I like, oh God. And I think that's when insight can be really helpful, because, and I find that a lot in packaging changes. It's like, it's so subjective. And then that's when you're like, let's just go back to the consumer. That's if, don't ask me, let's not ask you, let's ask the consumer and just go with that. It's really interesting because we had someone on recently, and I was saying there's no one way of doing it. And sometimes I feel like every episode of the podcast is like kind of there can be a lot of contradictions in it, which is also true because there's no one right way of doing it. And we had one recently where we talked about focusing on the core and not getting distracted with NPD. Do you guys have a core? Is there like a core part of the range that you protect when all this is going on?
We definitely do. We have a core set of products, which we call kind of core pulses and grains, which exactly is that. It sits in a very specific part of the store. We have 55% market share of that niche, smaller category. And yeah, that I totally agree with the protect the core, because that's ultimately the flagship and the heritage of where the brand started. But that doesn't mean that you can't iterate like that. NPD doesn't just mean launch into a totally new category in a different part of the store. It's be obsessed about, could we make that better? Is there any way we can make that better? Can we iterate that product, improve this, improve that? And actually being really hard on your core and saying, there's a tail, like there's always a tail. Like there must be a way where we can pull out these bottom two or three products and create something that sits in the top five. Keep on doing that. sweat the space for the retailers and just make sure your cause. No, totally. And the balance of time of our product and innovation team, it should be at least 50-50 on core renovation as it should on sort of going into your kind of bigger or your more, your bigger bets.
Yeah. And I guess MPD, like you say, retailers love it. You get a nice sort of continual sort of PR opportunity. Like it's, and people love new, don't they? That's, I was one of the sort of rules of FMCG is stick new on something and it'll sell well.
Yeah, no, and it's true. It's definitely true. Whether it's like limited edition, it's just bringing something interesting and exciting to the category, isn't it? Particularly when it's a boring old category like pulses and grains, let's face it.
So what have you learned about being acquirable? If someone's listening from a challenger brand and they're thinking about a future sale, what advice would you give?
Yeah, that's a good question. And having been a part of this a few times, it's interesting because there you think you know what the process is going to be like and how it goes through, but they're all so unique. But I guess the thing or something that definitely knits it all together is, I always just say demonstrate scalability, because ultimately if you zoom all the way out, somebody's going to pay for you if they believe that they can make it bigger and worth more than or more valuable than what they originally paid for it in its most simple form. Demonstrating true scalability is the most critical thing. And, you know, how you do that, is it, okay, let's go into export to prove that it can be international? It may be, but it doesn't have to be if you're a tiny part of a mega category. And the same thing around going into new categories. It's quite an obvious thing to demonstrate scalability and the brand can travel, but that doesn't have to be the answer. But I think really being able to look at yourself and say, is this a truly scalable business? I think is really important. I think keeping, we've probably touched on it really, but keeping really clear red lines around what actually does make this business difference and what does make it acquirable and something that people would pay for rather than build themselves. R1 is definitely product quality, health, ingredients, taste. Those things have to run through everything. And you have, I do think you have to stay quite true to those things. And also, I don't know, sometimes I look and say, would I buy? I think a really good question to ask yourself is, would I buy this business if I had a spare X million pounds or whatever, which I don't. But is this a business that I would truly buy, or I truly believe that there's a clear opportunity to double, triple, quadruple the size of this? That's such a good question to keep asking yourself all the time. And so, yeah, I find that sort of helps. And then probably, gosh, this is turning into a long thing now as I'm going down this rabbit hole. But I think probably the other thing is, it's a cliche, but cliches are often so accurate, aren't they? Focusing on building the business and just doing the basics really well. I think you can sometimes get distracted by the idea of planning something to a really elegant point where it's, okay, I'm going to get here and then the business will be highly acquirable, and worrying yourself over the margin needs to be this. Am I there? Or I haven't proven export yet. But actually, if you focus on a few of those things and you just build, the rest will, and you build something of really high quality, the rest will come.
Yeah, I think brands can fall into the trap of thinking too much about an exit, especially too soon.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you need to know, it's helpful to know who might my potential target acquirers be and what sort of shape do I want to be in, but not to a point where it distracts you from the day-to-day.
And do you think being acquired is still the end goal for most challenger brands, or is that just one version of success?
I think it probably does depend. I think it's a nice goal to have, because as we've said, if you focus on just build enterprise value all the time, then you're going to create a really strong business and valuable asset. But I don't think it always has to be. I think, again, a lot of people run things as lifestyle businesses that actually is really true to themselves and is something that they just feel really proud of. And perhaps at some point that comes to an exit when it gets to a point in that lifestyle business that it's not a lifestyle and it's becoming too much and a different set of skills are required. But I don't actually think the two things need to be. I don't think you don't always have to have worked that bit out right at the beginning. It's a question usually a lot of challenger brands and businesses need to raise. And then at that point, you do probably need to be quite clear that people who are investing are going to get a return on that investment. And you need to show that path. But before that point, I don't think it ultimately has to be a singular thing.
I think like lifestyle business is quite, can be seen as a bit of a derogatory term. I think it sounds great.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Love the idea of that. Yeah.
Okay, so wrapping up, I'm going to ask you a couple more questions. One lesson you'd pass on to your younger self?
Can it only be one? I've got a lot of things to say to my younger self. I'd probably say this is a horrible cliche, but then I always say old cliches are old cliches because they stand the test of time. It like just slow down and enjoy the journey. I think if you're in a hurry, like you're wasting your own time. And I've always been a bit obsessed about what's next and never really stopped to look around. And I realized for me, it's like not the pursuit of happiness, it's the happiness of pursuit, which actually is quite a comforting place to get to, because it's actually, I know when the business gets to this size or we sell the business or I get that promotion or whatever it is, I'm not actually going to be content with that, but that's okay. But then it really means you've got to enjoy what you're doing now. There was a really good, it's not really a quote, it's just something I heard on a podcast, which I just thought was quite a nice way to look at it, which was something like, if you can't take the time to enjoy a really good coffee, you're never going to enjoy a yacht. Do you know what I mean? It's like, you've got to like, just be grateful around the things around you and slow down. I've just always been in a rush. I think it's taken me too long to enjoy it a little bit.
As you get older, you start to see that, don't you, in a way that you've put in all of those hard yards, I think, of then reflecting on it and being like, okay, if I don't ever enjoy this, what's the point?
Because yeah, yeah.
It's that is life, isn't it? That's it.
Yeah. Young children help, Ruth.
They do.
Because they force you to slow down and they give you a lot of perspective.
I like that this is basically an episode about business and parenting.
I heard someone say the other day, you're only ever as happy as your least happy child. And I thought, oh God, that's so painfully true.
And then with the metaphor we were using earlier, apply to your least happy employee.
Yeah, no, it does. Yeah, no, it actually does. It really does. The times when I ever get stressed at work, which I would say is not that common, it will be a people thing, definitely. Because I really will feel that.
Okay, last question, and it's one that we ask everybody to wrap up. In your view, what makes a brand of tomorrow?
Yeah, I think my answer to that is probably just one on a more macro scale, which is I do think it's businesses or brands which are on a trend, but one which is in some way solving a broader societal problem or consumer need. Ours is very much around eat more plants or eat a bit less meat. And eat a bit healthier. And I do think businesses like that, they're a brand of tomorrow in respect of they can grow, but they're also a brand of tomorrow in respect of there is a role in food and consumer goods to actually help out with some of these broader societal problems. And it's interesting because taking it back to the acquisition from Premier, they've done such a good job more recently of acquiring businesses like ours because they recognize that trend and they recognize the need for it, and they have their own really clear targets on things like HFSS, etc. And there's a real role that brands like ours can play. So it probably also goes back to your question on making yourself acquirable as well, but definitely I'd love to think that the big brands and the exciting businesses of tomorrow are contributing positively from that side.
Perfect. Great. Thanks so much for coming on.
Not at all. Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.